apparently would have been stuck for a considerable period of time, because my discussions with others as we flew around the Sound that day in other locations, where they were all having the same problem with skimmers. And that in fact, as we start to piece together the evidence, while Exxon is telling us they have more and more assets on the scene, what we're finding is a high percentage of those assets are experiencing a considerable period of downtime, or just downtime in terms of their efficiency, their productivity.
Downtime as well as inability to deal with the oil in the state that it had evolved into. It didn't, you know, by the time they got to that point, it wasn't just crude oil on the water. It was crude oil saturated with water, which gives it a different type of, it's a different texture. It has to be dealt with in a different manner. That was also one of our frustrations, that every time they brought in another skimmer, they brought in a skimmer to deal with the oil as it is today. When they got here 4 or 5 days later, the oil had changed again and they couldn't deal with it again.
So there's constant weathering of the oil. Is that what you're suggesting?
That's correct. The continual weathering of the oil had a lot to do with the inability of it being dealt with. And it was never being addressed from a looking at it down the road point. It was being looked at as today and deal with it today type of thing.
Well, I guess I would say that I might find that to be somewhat of an acceptable excuse if maybe this was the port of Long Beach or the port of San Francisco or somewhere else where you might get crudes and streams of oil, and certainly the oil companies can respond to this, of different types from different areas of the world, from different fields, that have different properties. But here it would seem to me that again the company in charge, Alyeska, certainly had knowledge of at all times of what was coming down the pipeline. There's a fair amount of literature available in scientific circles about what happens to oil as it weathers. A number of studies have been run by the Canadians and others on what happens to this oil in cold climates and cold water and that sort of thing. And I continue to be somewhat amazed and obviously very disappointed by the incredible mismatch of assets and the problem in this particular case. And you know, the conclusion I left with 3 weeks ago was that but for the fishermen, nobody was affecting the flow of this oil around Prince William Sound, and the fishermen were essentially left to defending a few small coves where you had your cooperative hatcheries. But any other effort or any other notion, I remember at one point we flew in a helicopter for about 35 to 40 minutes over the oil, thick, dark oil, no problem seeing it, and never saw a cleanup vessel in sight. Now, I assume the helicopter had reasonable speed. I don't know how far we traveled. But essentially from Sawmill Bay back to Valdez is how far we traveled. And
there's not a whole lot I can add to that, Congressman, except to concur wholeheartedly with what you're saying. Your assessment is right on.
Well, I just... we'll see. We'll see where these hearings take us, but I guess I'm a little concerned that we're still in somewhat the same predicament where really the contingencies plan should have spent a lot more time talking about the involvement of fishermen, and rather than you calling Alyeska, Alyeska should have been calling you, and may have changed some of the outcome of this. Let me ask you this: how much have the fishermen purchased a fair amount of boom on their own out of your own treasury? Or?
The CDFU itself has not. PRISWAC did.
That's the organization.
Prince Sound Aquaculture Corporation. Yes, they did purchase a large amount of boom on their own out of their own pocket
for the defense of the hatcheries.
For the defense of the hatcheries.
Thank you, Mr. Owens.
Dr. Ott. You have an impressive educational background. You have a master's in oil pollution and a doctorate in sediment pollution, as I understand it.
That's correct.
You may be interested in some information given us yesterday. I'd like by Exxon, and I'd like you to appraise it for us, given your background. They said in our briefing that perhaps 50% of the oil has already degraded, biodegraded. That within a year, the rest will have been biologically degraded. That it is their judgment that once it's biodegraded, it is not dangerous. They found, as I understood it, no toxicity in the water itself, in the terms of the water columns, is it? No heavy metals down to 9 feet and so forth. And they think they'll have it all cleaned up by September 15th. That's 1989. Won't you comment on that for me, and then I'll give you my second of the two questions.
Since March 24th, I have not been able to read the comic papers, which is one of my favorite parts of the paper. However, I've discovered that a good substitute for the comics tends to be anything written by Exxon. I would have to ask the date of the document where they said that, well, I guess it doesn't matter. What I have to go on is the Glacier Bay spill. That was our laboratory 2 years ago. It was also with Prudhoe Bay crew.
I saw your reference to that. When and where did that take place, and when?
Right before the 4th of July in 1987. In that spill, that was only 125,000 barrels, or a tenth approximately, gallons. At any rate,
that would be about 10,000 barrels?
It was about a tenth of this spill. So you have to multiply 125,000 gallons times 40.
Congressman Wayne Owen of Utah is questioning Ricky Ott and other members of the CDFU panel.
The Coast Guard estimated after that spill that the total oil recovered was 12 to 18%. The oil remaining in the environment was 30 to 40%. The rest was evaporated, dispersed, or a large part was stranded on the beach's tar balls. I don't see any reason why this oil spill would weather any differently than the exact same oil spilled 2 years earlier. So I think that 50% is extremely optimistic on the part of the oil industry. As far as your question about biodegradation, once they're biodegraded, they're not dangerous. If the compounds are allowed to completely biodegrade, they may not be dangerous. However, some of the side effects of biodegradation are the animals don't get to completely metabolize these compounds. And often the metabolite compounds are more toxic. And he was pretty open to the idea that it's a possibility. And we have film footage of sunken oil, which we're getting.
The other, information which we obtained from him, was the most optimistic assessment, with the possible exception of Exxon yesterday, that the forces of nature will actually do the cleaning up work for us. He indicated that most of the areas which took the major hits are exposed to the oceans, and as such, being exposed to high energy, I hope I'm not misquoting him, by the ocean, will recover much more quickly. We were at Smith yesterday and saw some terribly distressed areas, terribly covered with oil. But he feels that Smith Island, though it took a very big hit, is also very exposed to the ocean, action, and within 1 year should recover quite quickly. I think that's an exact quote. Could you assess that?
Sure. Areas that are high-energy environments like Smith Island, I do expect to recover more quickly than the multitude of small coves and inlets along 400 miles of coastline to which oil has forced itself. It is these other environments that are the less energetic environments that the small salmon fry and many other juvenile life forms use as nursery grounds before they either migrate down and turn into adults or migrate out to sea. And it's these areas that the oil is going to remain in for a lot longer than an area like Smith Island. And it's these areas where the animals tend to concentrate. Also, all the birds tend to build nests and stuff back in these protected areas. And the oil is just going to be locked in those bays for a while.
So you tend to agree with him that Smith Island may be quite clean within a year?
I'm going to talk to him immediately afterwards, and I'm going to place a bet with him. I'm not sure what it's going to be. I think probably an ice cream cone. But in a year from now, Smith Island will still have oil on it. I would like to get his exact definition of recovered. I think there's still going to be quite a bit of oil there.
He's not here to defend himself, but maybe tomorrow. I've dug his name out here, but...
I respect Dr. Kennedy, so...
Your own personal opinion is that Smith will still be pretty polluted with oil a year from now?
Yes, I believe that there will still be oil on Smith Island, probably ground very deeply into the beaches. Probably the surface oil will be removed, but I think that deep down, take a shovel. Dave and I are going to go out on that beach. I'm going to get my ice cream cone.
Thank you very much. I just want to commend your associations for the fast action which you took to protect your interests and the interests of all Alaska and indeed of the country when there was a comedy of errors being played out on the main acting stage here. It seemed like to me that you took events in hand and responded very well, and I commend you for that.
That's why I live here. There's a very energetic people, and I really admire them.
This is Representative Fazio from Oregon.
I'd like to make a comment if I could. I don't think in my life and in my reading of history I can think of anything perhaps that parallels the situation we've had described to us by this panel, except perhaps what happened at Dunkirk at the beginning of World War II, where one of the world's great powers had to depend upon fishing fleet and pleasure boats to evacuate the remnants of their army from a failed mission. And in this case, one of the world's greatest corporations and greatest conglomerates, Alyeska, has had to likewise depend upon the efforts of a mosquito fleet, a fleet of fishing boats and sport fishing boats, and the local community to help them preserve some of the remnants of a great ecosystem. And I think that's a tragedy that's beyond belief and shows a complete collapse of the protections we're promised here. But I'll have more to say about that later.
Representative Durbin.
Add anything to that? I think that was a good summary of the situation. I only have one question, though, and that is, when it came to saving and protecting the fish hatcheries, do I understand the testimony? I understand there are quite a few hatcheries involved here, but do I understand your testimony that most, if not all of them, were saved due to the efforts of the fishermen as opposed to the larger corporation efforts?
I would have to agree with that, that the saving of the hatcheries was primarily the effort of the fishermen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I know that your testimony has raised a number of other issues with respect to Alyeska, and it's our intent to go into those at a later date when we have the luxury of not having the spill looming on the horizon. Thank you.
I'd like to ask that this attachments also be entered into the official record. I have two copies, one for Mr. Petrick and one for...
Without objection, so ordered. Thank you very much, all of you.
Chairman Miller, thanking the panel of mostly Cordova.
What we'll do here is we'll take about a five-minute break if we can, and then we'll come right back and start with the next panel that will be made up of Theo Polasek, who is the Vice President of Operations, Alyeska Pipeline Service, Ivan Hinman, who is the Vice President of Environmental Engineering for Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, and Peter Sarnacki, who is the is a Marine Supervisor, Alyeska Pipeline Service Company.
Chairman George Miller from Democratic California just announcing the committee will take about a five-minute recess. So far we've heard from John Devins, the mayor of Valdez, from Dennis Kelso and Frank Rue. Kelso, the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Frank Rue, the director of the Habitat Division of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We just heard from a panel composed of Ken Adams from CDFU, Jack Lamb, who's been kind of the Valdez operations manager for CDFU, vice president here, and he's been over here in Valdez for most of the spill, and from Dr. Ricky Ott, who was also with CDFU. Coming up, three people from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, and after the Alyeska speaks, that should conclude today's hearings. We will be back, and again, for those stations down the line, we will be continuing these hearings. But for now, from KCHU on the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Dave Hammack at the Valdez Civic Center. We will return with more live coverage of the oil spill hearings by the House Subcommittee on Water, Power, and Offshore Energy Resources following the committee's recess. This is Dave Hammack at the Valdez Civic Center Ballroom. We're back with more live coverage of special hearings by the House Subcommittee on Water, Power, and Offshore Energy Resources. The committee has just returned from a recess. Here is George Miller. Alyeska is due up next.
Mr. Chuck O'Donnell, Mr. Larry Shear, Shire be available for response. So as I swear you, if they would also just step forward, I could swear you as a panel, and then if we require their responses, we won't have to interrupt it. It's a practice of this subcommittee to swear all witnesses who appear before it in investigative hearings. Do you have any objections to being sworn?
No.
If you'd stand and raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
In order to inform you of your rights as a witness before the committee and the limitations on the authority of the subcommittee, the rules of the House of Representatives and the committee are on the table in front of you. Both sets of the rules have been previously provided to you. You are advised of your right to counsel. The role of counsel would be to advise you of your constitutional rights. Do you desire to be represented by counsel?
Counsel is with us, Mr. Chairman.
Counsel is with you. Counsel, identify himself for the record, please.
That's Mr. Chairman Larry Sims of the law firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher.
Mr. Polasek, we'll start with you.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The name is Polasek.
Polasek.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I have a short oral statement. My name is Theo Polasek. I'm here today as Vice President of the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company in charge of operations to assist you in your examination of this tragic event and the actions Alyeska and its owners have taken since March 24th to prevent a reoccurrence of this event. With me today at the witness table are Ivan Hinman and Peter Sarnacki. Mr. Hinman is Vice President of Alyeska in charge of Environment and Engineering. He will address questions related to water and air quality at the terminal in which the subcommittee has indicated some interest. Mr. Sarnacki is one of Alyeska's marine supervisors. He was out on the water for much of the time during Friday through Sunday after the spill and should be able to provide you with first-hand information on what happened. I will respond as best I can to your questions regarding the oil spill, the contingency plan, and related issues. Mr. Chuck O'Donnell and Mr. Larry Shire are also available in the room to assist me in responding to your questions. As you will appreciate, the factual background of the subcommittee's inquiry is very complex and is still being pieced together in the context of a number of ongoing investigations. While we do not have direct personal knowledge of all of the facts of possible interest to you, we will do our best to be responsive to your questions. Alyeska and its people do care deeply about the environment in which we live and work. We regret this tragedy and are learning all we can from it. Since the spill, we have been discussing with Alaska authorities, especially Mr. Kelso's office, important actions to reduce the potential that this kind of tragedy will ever occur again. Although you are understandably interested in what happened, we're hopeful that we can assist you in looking toward the future and applying the lessons we have learned from this tragic experience. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we'll now try to answer your questions.
Mr. Slonecki is not going to, does not have a formal statement?
No.
Okay. Quite a bit has been made of the distinctions between the contingency plan as approved, I believe it was late 87, if I'm correct, the most recent revisions of the contingency plan, where Alyeska was asked to put together a scenario on dealing with the spill of this magnitude, some 200,000 barrels, and the comparison between that plan and what in fact happened at the time of the incident and the remaining hours that Alyeska was involved in that spill. Can you tell us what your version of how you compare what was put forth in the contingency plan and what your response was?
Well, the contingency plan rather accurately portrayed what would happen in the case of a 200,000 barrel spill. And it never projected that there would be no environmental damage. That plan was put together with consultation, advice from consultants, and working with state and federal agencies to put that plan together. Now, I know in looking at it now and the consequences of that spill, certainly we have to reevaluate those goals that were in that plan and commit more resources to try to make sure that we can reduce the risk of this ever happening again.
Well, why don't you take us through what took place at Alyeska from the time you were informed. I believe we were told today that the Coast Guard had informed Alyeska personnel that this had happened.
Well, I'll attempt to do that. Of course, I wasn't in all the locations at all the times, but I'll attempt to re-instruct to the best of my knowledge. The word was received here in Valdez about 12:30, or 30 minutes after midnight on the 24th, and immediately the plan, which has been laid out very specifically in a rather military sort of fashion, was implemented. The word was immediately given to the one tug, the Solward, to go out to the vessel to provide assistance, and that was done within about 4 or 5 minutes after we got the word that there was a problem. And that tug was sent out for the safety of the people as well to assist in stabilizing the vessel or do whatever else could be done. That tug went out immediately, and as I understand it, arrived on scene perhaps at around 2:40 or so that morning. So fairly quick response was done immediately, and the rest of the people were mobilized and told to begin equipping the barge and getting it ready to go out for a response. Pardon? I'm not sure of the exact time, sir. It was sometime shortly after that.
Can somebody tell us what time that was?
The immediate response to develop to start getting equipment together would have began the moment we were notified of the spill.
So all the ground is done. You dispatched the barge. Now you're turning to starting to assemble them.
It was not the barge.
I mean, excuse me,
we dispatched the tug immediately, and that went out. We put out the word for the rest of the people to begin executing the plan to make arrangements to take out the material for all skimming operations and booming operations. At the same time, we opened up the emergency center.
What time was that?
We opened up the emergency center about 1:15. And about that time, and then about 1:30, the emergency center was opened in Anchorage. At this time, all the contacts were made, mobilizing, contacting people with the other oil spill co-ops in the state, notifying the oil spill are the people who are experts in dispersants and burning. We notified Exxon immediately that there was a problem so they could start their response. In fact, that was done one of the first things in the process. I probably should have said that just a little bit earlier, but that was done. So we have a whole list of notifications to get people mobilized to start the response to the spill, that they can start bringing in equipment and other materials that we're going to need if we know it's likely to be a big spill.
Who is the person at the Alaska facility who was responsible for response to an oil spill?
The terminal superintendent has the responsibility, and if he is not there, it's delegated to the marine supervisor.
Who was there that night?
The marine supervisor was there first, and then the terminal superintendent showed up a little later.
Okay, and then what did they do?
Well, they proceeded to implement the plan to get the equipment and materials headed out on the barge.
Could you identify those two people for me, please?
Well, Mr. Chuck O'Donnell is the terminal superintendent, and Mr. Larry Shire is the marine supervisor.
Okay.
The marine manager, pardon me.
So Mr. Shire and Mr. O'Donnell both reported to the facility after being notified?
That's correct.
At what time did the personnel that were expected to assemble this equipment report to the facility, or were they already there?
Well, the personnel were there already. We have on site, every shift, we have four people who are designated as the oil spill response people in the team. They're on site for every shift, and those are the first ones to be thrown into action. Immediately, there were four more people thrown into action from the marine section. There are four more, and then we brought down four from the power vapor. So fairly quickly, we had about 12 people working on the problem, and then we brought in other people that were called in who were off duty because it was night shift.
The people that were on site are there because they have other duties. They share other duties with that designation. In the event of a spill, they are then designated to become the people who respond to the oil spill. That obviously takes a priority.
Their primary objective is oil spill response and equipment maintenance. If they have time, they do other jobs. But their primary job is oil spill response and equipment maintenance on oil spill equipment. So they're there, they carry radios.
How many hours a week do they spend on equipment maintenance and oil spill responsibility?
I couldn't tell you exactly how many hours a week, but let me add that we have the other people that Terminal also train in oil spill response. So that's not the only number of them. We don't just have four people.
I guess I'm getting confused here between populations. You have four people on any given shift who are present at the facility who are there doing what?
They are there with a primary responsibility as oil spill response personnel. They carry radios on them at the same time if snow needs to be shoveled, or if they can assist in some other job at the terminal, they do that. But if there is an oil spill need, their job is to be at the boats, ready to go within 10 minutes. And that's our drill.
I understand that. Do they have other responsibilities at the facility when there is not a spill? 5 minutes before you got the phone call that there was a spill that you were notified, what were these individuals doing?
They might have been doing something at that moment that would have been...
I'm trying to determine here, because you said earlier that their primary responsibility was equipment maintenance and oil spill responsibility. If they had time, they were doing something else.
And so I don't know what they were doing at that instance.
When they go to work every day for 5 days a week or whatever shift they work, they report for the purposes of equipment maintenance and oil spill responsibility, or do they report for the purposes of being to tie up ships or to maintain other equipment?
They report with the primary responsibility of being an oil spill response group. If there is nothing that needs to be done that day particularly, they may end up doing some other work, and it's set in priority, but their primary response is oil spill response.
I guess we can go around here. Okay. So you had four people there, and then other people, is that correct? You had four people?
Four people who were designated oil spill response, but immediately when the call came out, you had 12 people who came down to help.
Okay.
Including those four.
And that was at what time did the other 12 people get there?
They're there immediately within 10 or 15 minutes.
So everybody was assembled By what time? 2 o'clock? 3 o'clock?
I would say before that. If it occurred at 12:30, the notice went out. I would guess that those were there perhaps about 1, but I'm speculating because I don't have that kind of detail.
Then what happened? What did they do then?
Then the people in the emergency center continue to call out other people, and very quickly you had another 15 or 20 or 30 people on the site assisting. And by 4 or 5 o'clock, you had another, there were a total of about another 50 or 60 people there that had come out in response. Part of the hierarchy of response and call out we have was that the larger the spill, the more people we call out to cope with it. And so these individuals were called out, and we also began calling out contractor people in that morning. And by 3:30 or 4 o'clock, we began to get contract people showing up on the site to help us.
The primary responsibility for assembling the oil, the response to the spill in terms of getting it, that was Mr. Shire's responsibility?
At that early stage, on site, getting
the Shire, can you come forward and tell us what was taking place in Alyeska at that time?
Yes, Chairman. Maybe to clear up a little few of the fine points, the Marine crew, which was available, so their collateral duties are ship tie-up, booming, boom checks, those types of activities, were available. There were immediately 9 people available, and others came from other parts of the terminal to assist them. The activities that they were involved in at that point were to mobilize equipment, stage cranes, forklifts to carry this equipment, and all told, approximately 50,000 pounds of equipment were loaded on the contingency barge, and 22,000 pounds of equipment were loaded on the tug Pathfinder, which was designated as the lightering tug. That activity started at 0030 with the call out and continued until actually Exxon had taken over the predominance of those duties, and we stand ready today to assist Exxon should they need.
We'll back up here. You were assembling this, you were loading equipment onto the barge, and you're now at what time in the morning?
The barge loading.
The Pathfinder's loaded. The Pathfinder has not left, though, right? That's going out later to lighter, but it's going to take equipment out? Is that what you're saying?
No, sir. The Pathfinder, excuse me if I refer to times.
Sure.
The Pathfinder loading was taking place from 0030, or that group of equipment was being assembled from 0030, and it departed approximately 11 a.m. from the terminal. The tug Sea Flyer, which was designated as the lightering equipment carriage tug, departed the terminal at approximately 0950.
And the barge departed when?
At 1100.
And it was carrying what?
It was carrying boom, both containment and absorbent boom. On deck it had skimmers, generators, lighting devices, pumps, bladders. And alongside, it was also lashed in that flotilla were two Marco self-advancing skimmers, workboats, and additional containment boom in what's called CPACs.
Now, all of that was sent out to the scene?
Yes, sir.
And that arrived at Bly Point at what time?
It arrived on scene at approximately 14:30 or 2:30 p.m.
2:30 p.m.?
2:30 p.m.
It was about 4 hours. 4 hours in transit left before the morning.
Yes, sir.
What time frame, sorry?
Now, when did Exxon start to take over the process here?
I was on scene that evening when Exxon appeared. They came in about 6 o'clock that afternoon, and there were approximately, I think there were about 12 people who came in, and immediately when they came in, they took over the responsibility for the lightering that was going on, that activity, the dispersants, and the public relations. They held a press conference at like 6:30. We held some meetings with the Exxon folks that evening, telling them
what we had put in place, all the equipment that we had committed for, where, when it would be arriving on scene, and where we had our boom and our equipment deployed out in Prince William Sound. And so that transition then began at that point. We worked the transition through Saturday. By Saturday, they had more of their people on site, and we then, as they wanted us to, began to bring our people back as they got their people into service on the equipment out in Prince William Sound. Our last supervisors came off Sunday evening. Mr. Sarnacki came off Sunday evening.
Why would they trade your people for their people in the middle of a crisis where we're not exactly asset rich at this point?
Well, the assets that we had out there, our equipment, we were manning it, and when they came out and we took it over and they were comfortable with taking it over, then our people came back. If they had desired our people to stay on longer, they would have. So we worked the transition. We continue to work with Exxon for the next couple of weeks in the area of logistics support, purchasing, a lot of other activities, communication for almost another 2 weeks. We didn't hand off anything till they were ready and they said they had it covered. And that's when we handed it off to them.
Well, with all due respect, what led you to believe that they had it covered?
Well, because they have had experience in dealing with oil spills. In fact, some of the people who had come in were reflecting that they had just come from the oil spill that they had off Hawaii. And they had experience. They have a team. They train as a team. They have a plan that they submitted to the state regarding dealing with oil spills.
Pardon? So do you.
Yes. But we're an agent for them. And we operated as an agent until they, as the owner company, said they were ready to take over.
Well, then let me get this straight. Under that scenario, I'm not sure I'd want to sign a contingency plan with you.
Well, sir, there were no surprises in that because we had drilled the handoff to one of the owner companies in May of 88, and the ADEC was there, most of the members of the region response team, the city was there, the Coast Guard was there. We went through a three-day drill where we went through the drill of a handoff to make sure it could be as smooth as possible. So there were no surprises to anyone.
And when did you hand that drill off?
When did we hand the drill off?
To ARCO.
In ARCO, we did the drill in May of 88.
And when in the drill did you then transfer the responsibility to the member company?
That drill simulated the first day, Alyeska's response. The second day was the drill of the response and handoff to ARCO. And the third day, we demonstrated our equipment for all the people who were here who were interested. We took out our skimmers, we took out our booms, and demonstrated that on the third day.
You demonstrated your equipment how?
By taking it out into the sound, and we did containment booming, we did exclusion booming, we picked up oranges, which is what the state generally drills us with. They'll throw oranges out on the water, and we're to pick those up with our skimming equipment. In fact, they had a drill the year before, in the late part of 87, where they called a surprise drill on us, and we went out and picked up the oranges because they tend to float in patterns somewhat like oil well. They practice you on the deployment of your equipment.
So the drill to pick up the oranges went fairly well?
Yes, they were very complimentary.
And it was what? But my understanding was that the handoff there took some place around 48 hours after the drill had begun.
No,
we should not interpret that was standard operating procedure.
No, our objective was to complete, if possible, the handoff within 48 hours. That was the objective. The objective was that the owner company would be in as quickly as possible, hopefully within less than 24 hours, and certainly Exxon was. They were here in like 18 hours from Houston and other places around the country. But the equipment was moving long before they got here from all parts of the world. I was on the phone early Friday morning talking to people in Southampton, England. We're getting equipment here to supplement what we had on site, because the equipment response was also planned to be a tiered type response. The larger the spill, the more places in the world you go to get equipment, just like you would in a firefighting situation. The bigger the fire, the more places you go around the country to call in firefighters. The same strategy.
Well, I just, because I'm reading the insider here, which says it assumed that ARCO had assumed administrative responsibilities after 48 hours, and this handoff went smoothly on the drill, which I guess is quite correct. And yet, I find some inconsistency that we're now about to hand off the largest oil spill in the continental United States in a matter of a few hours, and I don't understand what led you to believe that they could deal with this. When you supposedly had the trained drill team on site ready to go and go out and was familiar with this sound, with the environment and the situation.
Sir, the handoff was not immediate. It was a very phased handoff. In fact, like I said, some of the final handoffs didn't take place for 2 weeks or more. Immediately, the dispersant decision, the lightering decision, and public relations, they took over. And the other things just phased into a period that went over a period of about 2 weeks. We didn't back out of anything so long as they wanted us in there and our assistance, whatever it was, people, equipment. They kept our oil skin equipment out there for a long period of time. We had to fill it in from other sources around the world back to get our terminal back up operating because they still had it. And that was fine.
It appears that Exxon took over the PR and took over the lightering.
And the dispersant discussions.
And the dispersant. Who took over the cleanup?
The cleanup was in our hands through that night, through Friday, into Saturday, in the sense of what we were doing with our equipment out in the sound. We were in control of it. Mr. Sarnacki, who was working there at the time, he didn't know when we actually made the handoff to Exxon, because through Saturday and Sunday, the instructions to him would come from us in our emergency center. But we were in concert with Exxon so that what we did met their strategy of where they wanted to be. And so we kept it up until they said, fine, we've got, and they had their people on board the ship. And then when that happened, then Mr. Sarnacki would come in and their man would take over.
Well, I guess I'm just at a loss to understand what you were handing off, because there's no evidence in that same time period that anything was going on with respect to the spill other than the lightering, and I don't want to make light of that, but
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If I might, I'd like to speak on this. I'd like to identify when I came into the situation, the spill situation, to begin with. I'm a Marine supervisor. There are four Marine supervisors on duty at the terminal. We work 12-hour shifts. I was off duty at the time of the spill, but was called in on Friday, and I assembled my group of people to respond offshore. There's been a lot of negative criticism generated about Alyeska's lack of activities and response. And being there, I'd like to give you paint somewhat of a picture for you on what we actually were involved with. Friday evening, we deployed in the vicinity of over 11,000 feet of boom. We had boom set up as a diversionary measure from the stern of the Exxon Valdez to help divert the oil into the deeper section of the channel. We had deployed another diversionary boom behind the stern of the Exxon Valdez, approximately 1,600 foot, to help protect Reef Island and Bligh Island area. We had put in place exclusionary booming around the Reef Island perimeter and also in the cove of Bligh Island to help protect those sensitive areas that the oil was headed towards. We had the boom positioned, the 7,000 feet of boom position, diversionary boom position, to prepare to encircle the tankers once the priority of lightering had been established with the Baton Rouge coming alongside. Because it's physically and it's impossible to encircle a tanker with a, you can physically do it, but it doesn't have any logic involved if you try to encircle it with the boom when you're trying to position a lightering vessel. And lightering was established by the on-scene commander, Coast Guard, as being the number one priority because we had a potential for another million barrels in that tanker. The following day, we received more boom. My calls that went in was to get as much boom out on site, which is why we took time to assess the situation that we had so that we could hit this monster with the maximum amount of boom that we could gather. By Saturday, we put another approximately 12,000 feet of boom in service to control the leading edge of the spill, to hold it for the dispersant drops. And for a day and a half, we controlled the leading edge of the majority of the spill. Now, there's been a lot of reports that there was no boom in service, and that is simply not true, because I deployed the majority of the boom that was in service out there. There was a lot of activity. The skimming equipment was continuously operating. We had minor mechanical difficulties with some to be expected, but we kept skimmers operating around the clock. We kept crews operating around the clock.
Booming of the vessel. We knew we could, in the beginning, we had to wait till the Exxon Baton Rouge came alongside. And we had contacted the ship Friday afternoon, and I don't know the exact time, sometime between 3 and 4 o'clock, and asked if they wanted the ship boom, and they said no, not then. And this is the Coast Guard or the shipmaster, I'm not sure which at the time, gave the word back to us. But at that time, they were still trying to position the Baton Rouge in place. Later that night, we again checked with them about 9 o'clock, and they said no, not yet. So we were waiting to have the instructions from the Coast Guard or the master on board to make the determination when it was safe to boom that vessel. Because you realize that by daylight on Friday morning, almost all that oil was already gone and out on water. And booming could not have contained much at daylight, but still we would have done it, but we're waiting for the instructions from the Coast Guard as to when to encircle the boom around the ship. And Mr. Sarnacki deployed it to deflect the oil out into the deep water, which is where we wanted it for dispersant, and that also protected Bly Island, which was another thing we attempted to do. And then as soon as the word came, we could just simply take that boom and encircle the ship, which is what we did the next day. We got word at 11 o'clock to do it, and by 2 o'clock the boom was around. And that also protected Bly Island, which was another thing we attempted to do. And then as soon as the word came, we could just simply take that boom and encircle the ship, which is what we did the next day. We got word at 11 o'clock to do it, and by 2 o'clock the boom was around.